The Tom Woods Show, episode 875.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, join Bob Murphy and me for the libertarian event of the year, the Contra Cruise. And this year, we're joined by special guests, including the great Scott Horton, the foreign policy expert you love from The Tom Woods Show. It's filling up faster than ever, so book right now at ContraCruise.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. We are taking apart an article today. Once in a while, people send me articles and say, why don't you smash this one? And now and then I do that. Sometimes it'll be an article on a subject that I feel like I've covered so many times, I just don't want to do it again. Or sometimes I just don't want to give a certain person an additional audience. But sometimes I do go ahead and do it. And in this case, I've brought David Gordon onto the show to help me do it. The article is on taxation and theft and why taxation is not theft. And it's written by a philosophy professor named Philip Goff. And I wanted to have David come on and wrestle a bit with some of the particular arguments advanced in this particular article. So I do want to tell you, David Gordon is probably the most knowledgeable person I know. I don't know why I'm saying probably. He is a freak of nature. Let's just be frank about it. He knows so much about so many things. It's unbelievable. If you don't believe me, you'll see him at a lot of Mises Institute events. Just corner him and ask him some obscure question. And it can be about economics, it can be about history, it can be about philosophy. You can just go on down the line. And chances are he knows something about it. He knows all the references. He knows the scholarly debates. It's unbelievable. So he's a great guy to know, because when everybody else is stumped on something, you say, well, I can always ask David, which is what I do a lot. Might as well ask David, because he'll know the answer. David Gordon is a senior fellow of the Mises Institute, and he holds his PhD in intellectual history from UCLA. David, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be back.
I'm linking to this article, so assume that people have access to it, on why taxation isn't theft. And I have to say, when I got to the end of this article and I found out the author was a professor of philosophy, I was a bit surprised. I thought this was going to be some kid with a blog. I really could not believe this is a professional philosophy professor. Now, I mean, maybe philosophy professors are much worse than I thought they were or something, but let me just ask you right from the start, is it just that I'm not familiar enough with philosophical arguments, or is it that this really is a pretty weak... I mean, were you surprised this was a philosophy professor saying this?
Well, what surprised me about the article was that political philosophy isn't this guy's specialty. His name is Philip Goff. His specialty is metaphysics. He's known for working on panpsychism, which is the view that all matter has some mental properties. He has a book coming out with Oxford on that. But he doesn't usually write on political philosophy. What he's doing in the article, he's really just popularizing, or explaining very briefly, two influential arguments. The one was where he discusses, do people have a legal right to their pre-tax income? He's just popularizing a line of argument in a book by Thomas Nagel and Liam Murphy called The Myth of Ownership. And then the other part, which is on the moral question, which I think would account for your low view of him, he's really, again, just pointing to certain kinds of popularizing, but he doesn't do a very good job of explaining. He just seems to say, well, isn't it obvious we don't deserve our incomes? But he doesn't really explain why he thinks that very coherently.
Right. So let me take over here and give people a sense of what's being said here. What this Professor Goff is trying to say is that we often hear it said that we should cut taxes so that people can keep more of their money. Now, he's willing to entertain the possibility that you might want to cut taxes to foster whatever, capital investment or something. Fair enough. But to say that we need to cut taxes to give people more of their money contains a number of assumptions that he believes are faulty. Now, the legal one he doesn't spend that much time on. It's the moral claim. He's basically claiming you don't really have any moral claim on the income that you receive on the market because the market is amoral and arbitrary. It just happens to have bestowed this money on you. And he gives the example of a banker who earns a lot of money versus a scientist researching a cure for cancer. Well, virtually everybody would think the scientist is providing the more valuable service, so therefore it's totally arbitrary from a moral standpoint that he earns as little as he does as compared with the banker. So how can we say, well, these market outcomes are the best outcomes there are? These market outcomes precisely award people what they morally deserve. Certainly they don't. So therefore, why do we hold them in this with this in this superstitious reverence? So that's what I'd like to hear your response to.
Well, I think the fundamental problem with what he says is he's making a confusion between desert and entitlement. When he's talking about desert, he means something like, is it due to some kind of moral virtue on your part that you have money? Like, is it, say, this banker? Is the banker done something that's morally better than, say, a poor school teacher who's slaving away? Or does, Frank Sinatra made a whole lot of money, but was he a very good person? Probably not. So what this view is, well, people don't really deserve especially their high income because the income isn't proportional to their moral merit. But the mistake there is on the view that I think is the most plausible one, people have rights over their self and their property because they've acquired them through just procedure. So it isn't that you're morally better if you're earning a high income, but if you're doing in a way that didn't violate anybody's rights, you're entitled to it. Like, is it perhaps this would bring out the point a bit better? I suppose most people, most contemporary left-wingers would say people have free speech rights. We'll put aside the question, well, there's certainly forbidden topics where you don't have free speech rights. But most leftist inclined philosophers would say, well, we have free speech rights, but we could say, oh, what some people say, like you, Tom, are extremely articulate. Is this because you deserve this morally? Maybe you should be penalized, say, when you're talking as against a less articulate person like me. You know, you didn't morally deserve to be a very good speaker, so maybe you should be penalized. You see, we could see it's pretty obvious. This is not the right way to look at it. It's just, you are entitled to your free speech rights. It isn't that you're especially virtuous or not virtuous, and that determines whether you have the right or not. But it's just if, according to what you consider the best account of moral theory, you have the right to your speech or the right to your property, then it can't be taken away from you.
But there would be the source of the disagreement. They would say that there's something wrong with that moral theory if it allows somebody who they believe is contributing nothing but trivia to society. I mean, let me take something that's dear to your heart, David Gordon, and we'll say wrestling.
Yeah.
There would be a lot of people who would say that a wrestler who wrestles for entertainment is not providing as much value to society, let's say, as a school teacher, who is, without thinking of his own material well-being, is imparting knowledge to young people, and yet the wrestler winds up with all this dough. Now, you may have some libertarian theory of rights that tells you that the wrestler can keep what's given to him, but that's precisely what we're disputing here. The libertarian theory of rights gives us such a morally grotesque outcome that we have to throw the whole thing out.
Well, if they said that, then one would want to know, why do they think this is a morally grotesque outcome? They might have some view in mind. Well, there are certain types of goods or values that are objectively higher than others, and so distribution should be in accordance with those, say, wrestling, pro wrestling isn't, in their view, very valuable. So pro wrestlers shouldn't really get large sums of money. And of course, they have to give some argument in defense of that. But I think just trying to take the argument on their own terms, we could say, and this is a point that Ludwig von Mises stressed a great deal, the market is giving consumers what they want. It may not be satisfying the values of the people who have negative views of wrestling. Of course, they're bad people anyway. But people do want wrestling. People are willing to pay large sums of money to see wrestling. It adds up, so people want to see wrestling. That's why wrestlers are able to earn high salaries. So people are getting you're getting income in the free market according to the way you provide services to consumers. Now, one point I think additional could be raised here, and this is one that Friedrich Hayek stressed a great deal. If we talk about sort of a set of objective values and try to distribute in accord with that, that would suggest that all the resources are owned by society, some kind of collective body, and that we have to assign these resources to various people and according to some objective scale of values. But just what we have in a market system is that this isn't true. There's just individuals who start off with certain allotments of property and income, and then we have a process by which people engage in exchanges and investment and so on, and then people will then get more income to the extent they satisfy the wishes of the consumer. So there's no central process of distribution in accord with one set of values. And Hayek also points out, if we try to say, oh, well, maybe we should just get rid of the market, you know, and just have some process where we do distribute in terms of this set of values, they're going to be all sorts of disagreements about what this objective scale of values is, and the result will tend to be a totalitarian imposition of a particular set of values on the rest of society.
So this is in some ways a subset of the larger question that philosophers have wrestled with about the moral significance of luck more generally.
Yes.
And how we're to make a reckoning of luck. And I mean, I think John Rawls tries to deal with the question of luck, because of course your endowments, your mental endowments, let's say, or your physical ability or whatever, these things are, again, they would say, something you did not deserve. You were born with them. You just got them. And so therefore they can imagine a moral scenario in which it makes sense that the fruits of those talents, namely the income that you might enjoy, ought to be redistributed to people who, through no fault of their own, did not come into possession of those same talents. These might be people who work just as hard. Or actually, I shouldn't even say work just as hard, because a work ethic is also luck in the view of some of these people, that even that isn't something you should point to and say, I did this. So, but anyway, I mean, look, it could be the case that I am a really terrific chess player, and you, David Gordon, on the other hand, are a brilliant surgeon and a physician, and you've just sold a brand new drug for $200 million. Now, it's just, you know, it's too bad that the talent I have doesn't generate really any income, and the talent you have generates all that income. That's the society that I'm unlucky enough to live in, unfortunately. So anyway, the bottom line is, because of luck, people are in the situation they're in, and then we go from there to what seems to be the non sequitur of, therefore, the state plays a role, the state should basically take your extra stuff. And yeah, of course, they're going to redistribute it after they take their they skim their fee off the top. But again, I mean, is this basically the same issue? I mean, I'm sorry if I keep dwelling on this, but I just I feel like we need to have an absolute smash, pithy home run to that.
Oh, yes. Well, I think one suggestion might be if we got rid of everything they consider to be luck, there'd be nothing left. There'd no persons at all. They would just eliminate all the attributes of anyone. And then you would have a question. They've gotten rid of dessert altogether. So their view is really contradictory. They're saying nobody deserves anything because of luck, but then the people they want to favor, say the poor or various other people, really deserve to get more than they do now. It's really an odd view. Nobody deserves anything, but some people really deserve more than they're getting on the market.
Okay, so there is a bit of a problem then, logically, with what it is they're saying. These people definitely deserve X.
Yes.
But nobody really deserves anything.
And one point.
But I think this, but I think, hold on a minute. I think Professor Goff, though, is not saying nobody, we can't figure out dessert. It's that I certainly know that the arbitrary judgments of an impersonal market is definitely not yielding a result that I need to respect.
Well, but then if he says that, I mean, then he evidently has in mind some view of what people should be getting, what dessert is. He has in his mind some view of what is the proper distribution, but he doesn't really tell us what it is. And here, I think there's another basic problem with this luck view that people really are unlucky. Some people are unlucky. Others are, would apply to what Goff is saying. People, you know, obviously people don't deserve what they get in the market. When you talk about luck or what people are very lucky, this is relative to a certain idea of what you think the proper distribution should be. Say if you think everybody should get an equal amount of resources, then people who have certain natural endowments that enable them to make a lot more, or you could say are very lucky. But I mean, supposing you held a view that really we should have the people who are born with certain superior endowment should really get nearly everything. Say view that Nietzsche held, you know, we should really try to help those who were the great creative geniuses. They're the main one. So then you could say, even if they're getting, it might be even if they're getting a lot of money, maybe they're unlucky because they're not getting as much as they should be according to that theory. So the problem for the luck egalitarian is you can't specify whether people are lucky or unlucky unless you have a particular distribution in mind that you think is the correct one, but then it's circular if you say that people are getting the wrong amount of money because they're either lucky or unlucky. It's relative to a distribution. This is a point, incidentally, was made by Murray Rothbard years ago, and there was a philosopher, Susan Hurley, who had a book just dealing with this point. She's not at all libertarian, but she had a very fairly long book just going into this view, you know, problems of your luck is relative to a distribution. And so this is the point they miss. So the basic point I make about Goff's article is when he says, oh, well, isn't it obvious that people aren't getting what they deserve? The market is just rewarding people arbitrarily. I think if he just puts it like that, the answer is no, this isn't obvious at all. We want to ask him, well, what is the account you have that permits you to say that? Why should we hold this? And if he says, well, look, there are certain, isn't it objectively the case that certain activities are better than others? You could say then, even if you're right, what is the reason for thinking that people should earn incomes in accord with whether they produce how they produce according to the set of objective values. I mean, it's really just the article is just really a string of assertions on his part.
And then there is, I think, a utilitarian point to be made that we would be stuck in endless disputes with one another because we do have different value systems, a lot of us, from each other. And maybe I think one particular class of people, you know, who work in some field deserve money more than people in some other field. And Professor Goff may think it's the other way around. And then so how are we ever to resolve who is to get what, if not just, well, let people get what people are voluntarily willing to give them?
Yeah, yes. I mean, this is a point that Hayek stressed a great deal. And one thing we can draw a parallel here. Of course, we have disputes in politics all the time. You know, some people favor certain policies, others don't. We have irresolvable disagreements about this. And one way that's generally accepted, I mean, libertarians would have some problems with it. We can use this argument against people like Goff, who share general leftist views. It's one way we try to solve these political problems is we have a democratic system in which people vote on what they prefer, and the ones who are in the majority win out. And as Mises stressed a great deal, this is what happens in the free market. We have these conflicts. Say we have conflicts. Some people like wrestling. Others, say, like going to classical symphonies. So we have people are voting for what they want by purchasing the various products. And the advantage of the free market over political democracy is in most democratic systems, if you're in the minority, then you don't get what you want. But in the free market, you still can, as long as there are enough people who have similar preferences to make production of what you want profitable. So the way we settle disputes about values in the free market is quite similar to it, but better than the way we settle disputes about political values in a democratic political system.
I want to ask you something that's unrelated to this article directly, but it touches on the same sort of thing. Of course, when taxation comes up and we talk about really fundamental questions like, is taxation just? Is taxation theft? One of the things that comes up in defense of taxation, of course, one of the arguments is the social contract, and we've implicitly agreed to abide by what the state says and to make contributions and whatever. But that's a fairly weak argument. There are a lot of problems with the social contract, and so libertarians have been pretty good at answering those. But I had somebody raise in my private Facebook group the following objection to that, just for play devil's advocate. He said, well, if you're going to argue that the social contract is not valid because, you know, one way or another, I never really consented to it, well, what do we say about a child who is born on private property, as nearly all of us are, and has not consented to anything, and yet we treat that person as if he has consented to abide by the rules of private property? Isn't that just as illegitimate as the social contract? Why are we willing to accept this kind of reasoning when it comes to private property, but we reject it indignantly when it comes to the state? What's the difference?
Well, I think that objection is interesting. You see, I don't think the person would really want to press that, because what he would be saying is it's just because of the way we treat children, it's justifiable for the state to treat us as if we were children. That I don't think that's a direction that seems very promising. I mean, presumably the reason we think that children lack until they gain as they grow up, they lack rational faculty, so they're unable to think and decide for themselves. They lack both rational faculty and their physical capacity to do so, and, you know, then they mature. So what this objector is saying is, well, since children don't consent, isn't there just as much justification for treating adults as if they were children? I don't think that's a very good, I mean, maybe, you know, with the, if that's the way he's going to justify the state, I think we could say, you know, the way Kant says in preface to one, he says, you know, God protect me from my friends, from my enemies, I can defend myself. That isn't a very good good defense of the state, is it?
But let me try to give it a more reasonable exposition then. All right, so that's true that just because we treat children a certain way doesn't mean we would want the state to treat adults that way. I get that. But doesn't that just postpone the question? Because is there a moment when we can say that as we get older, we expressly consent to the rules of the private property order? And we say, this is the society I want to live in. And what form does that consent take? And how is that consent more explicit than the alleged consent of the social contract?
Oh, I see. That's a very interesting point. See, the problem there is that suppose you say you have a right not to be assaulted by me or anyone else. You know, I can't just come up to you and punch you out. Not, I mean, that wouldn't be a very good way of doing it. It wouldn't have good consequences for me if I did. But I mean, the rights people have don't, those natural rights don't rest on consent at all. So it isn't that, say, imagine you're an adult and you're finding, you know, we have all these property rights. People have all these property rights. Say, you know, here's this billionaire over here who has all these assets. Maybe I'd like to take them. You know, now they say I can't do it because it's his property. Well, I never consented to that. But I mean, the property rights don't rest on consent or people accepting that arrangements. It's just according to kind of a libertarian view of things, people just have those rights. The difference in politics is that the state is claiming to have certain rights over us that aren't natural rights, and then one of the reasons that they say, well, they can do these things to us even though they don't have a natural right to, is that people have consented to it, you've agreed to it. And then, of course, arguments that, in fact, you haven't agreed are very relevant. But the case is quite different with libertarian rights, because it isn't that the libertarian view rests on some sort of social contract by which we all agree to recognize libertarian rights. It's not a contractual view at all.
But again, I'm just to play devil's advocate one last time, given that there are plenty of people who disagree with libertarian rights theory. In fact, well, let's be honest, almost everybody. I mean, they accept it to some degree, obviously, right? I mean, everybody to some degree accepts the idea of the right of property. But they would say, look, most of us don't accept your crazy extreme libertarian view. And yet you're just going to belligerently claim that our consent isn't really necessary because these rights are all natural. Well, I don't think they're natural. And then we're stuck, is what they would say.
Yes. Well, I think I think one would just say we believe that you'll find that if you follow the rules, you'll find it's in your long-term interest to do so. But I would be inclined to push back a bit at this style of argument. I mean, let's say you believe that abortion is morally wrong, that people who provide abortions are engaged in something tantamount to murder. So then you say, well, we should have laws against this. I don't think you would entirely find a convincing argument, although there's certainly people who made this style argument. I wouldn't find it convincing to say something like, well, even if you think that, you have to recognize that many, if not most people, don't think that, at least in all the circumstances that you do. So how can you justify and forcing people to accept what you think is the correct view when they don't? I don't think in general, you know, although it certainly has to give weight to people's views of things. I don't think there's a general right, or at least I haven't consented to such a right, where people get to refuse to accept any rights claims that they don't find plausible. I mean, there could be certainly practical problems of, say, you're in a society where most people don't accept the view you think is correct. How are you going to secure that view? But that's a different question from if people have certain rights, they're entitled to have them regardless of whether other people accept that or not. I mean, supposing, let's take another case. I mean, supposing you practice some kind of religion that is very unpopular. So, and then you say, well, you believe you have freedom of religion. I don't think it would be such a good response to say, oh, well, but people, you may think you have freedom of religion, but people didn't agree to that. They don't consent. They don't really like your religion. So therefore, you'll have to put up with certain measures of suppression against it.
Before I let you go, David, I want to ask you, who do you think in right now, living today, are some good libertarian philosophers? Are there any?
Oh, yeah. Yes, well, I think they're quite some very good people. I mean, now, I like Hans Hoppe a great deal, a lot of people.
No, I don't believe that. Really?
Yes,
I'm just kidding. Yes,
no. Hans, I mean, I would say he's the most maligned of all the libertarian philosophers, but he has a very original way of looking at things. There, another one I like, Doug Rasmussen, Doug Denial. There's kind of Eric Mack, Lauren Lomasky, Michael Humer. Gary Chartier has some interesting things, although I don't always agree with him. Well, I don't always agree with I don't even agree with myself all the time, but I think there's one thing. I think there's a libertarian philosophy is political philosophy is quite promising. Jason Brennan is another one who's attracted some attention. He's very prolific. I think all of these people are worth reading, but I personally think kind of the Rothbardian view is the correct one. And you know, unfortunately, some of the younger libertarian philosophers don't read Rothbard as much as they should. Oh, another one's name, David Schmitz at University of Arizona, is certainly worth reading. Jerry Gauss at Arizona. You know, there are various people who were connected in some ways or other with somewhat libertarian approaches. You know, they're not, unfortunately, not as hard line as I'd like, but it is a quite a growing field of thought, I think.
I think, just if I'm getting this right, I think every single name you mentioned has been a guest on the show, which is in one way really great. It means, you know, I've found some really great people. On the other hand, that's depressing. I don't want to know all the great thinkers. I want there to be so many I couldn't possibly know them all. But anyway, at least I'm on the right track. And that's because
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, it's just like Murray said, you know, one time the libertarian movement started out in his apartment. Somebody could say the libertarian philosophy is starting out. It's appearing on your show. And
on my show, exactly. Now, I should correct myself there, though. The person I get the most requests for is Hans, and he's more or less retired from doing audio interviews. I've discussed this with him on more than one occasion. And in fact, he emailed me, how long ago was it? And he asked me something, or what did I want to come to his event? And I just said I just couldn't make it work. But, you know, short of that, I'd love to have you on the show. And then crickets. No reply. He just does not want to do that stuff anymore. So I get that question all the time. So if you were inclined to email me, why don't you get Hans Hoppe on? It's fruitless. It's not going to happen. But I can talk to David Gordon, which is just as good. So thanks again, David.
Oh, thanks, Tom. Nice talking to you.
All right, everybody, before I let you go, here's a great one. Here is a great one. This is another site created by a listener of this show, and boy, are you going to love this idea. The site is called libertyminecraft.com, and it's aimed at gamers, at young people, at students, and parents. And to give you just a quick overview, Liberty Minecraft is a practice environment for people to play Liberty and learn what freedom is like. Now, Minecraft, as you may know, is the second best-selling game of all time, 122 million copies. That's number one in sales across all computer platforms. Around 80% of those, at least 100 million copies, can access Liberty Minecraft in under 1 minute. The creator has been working on this project for 3 years. It's funded by donations. He says his goal is to provide 10,000 hours of experience in free markets, liberty, morality, and capitalism over the next year. So check this out. It's really neat. LibertyMinecraft.com. I will link to it at TomWoods.com/875, as the listener website mentioned. And of course, my longtime listeners know that this particular site is getting mentioned on the show because the creator used my link to get the web hosting for the site. And if you do that, I'll give you this publicity. I'll link to you on my site. I'll give you a couple dozen free video tutorials, and you can be added to my private bloggers group if you so choose. These are great bonuses, and you too can get them. Check out the details at TomWoods.com/publicity. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.